11 days later, the Republican launched his 2024 candidacy. This afternoon, the Attorney General named a special counsel to help oversee the investigations into both the Mar-a-Lago scandal and a probe into Donald Trump's alleged misconduct on 6th of January 2021. The appointment, Merrick Garland said, underscores the department's commitment to both independence and accountability in particularly sensitive matters. Merrick Garland added, Mr. Smith will begin his work as special counsel immediately. Though many anticipated such an appointment, the move is not without controversy. Justice Department officials have spent months in the January 6th matter, more than a year, examining the details of Donald Trump's alleged misdeeds, and there's no obvious need to bring in someone new who hasn't been involved in the probe up until now. Many have argued that such a move is politically necessary. In light of Donald Trump's 2024 kickoff, it's unrealistic, the argument goes, to think that President Joe Biden's Attorney General could credibly indict Biden's former and potentially future rival. Naming an independent counsel will offer political insulation against allegations of abuse and reassure the public about the integrity of the process. At least, that's the theory. In practice, there's no reason to believe that Donald Trump and his followers will be impressed. No matter who's overseeing the investigations and scrutinizing the evidence, Republicans will reject the idea that the matter has been handled in a fair and an even-handed way, even if it's been handled in a fair and an even-handed way. Indeed, a spokesperson for the former president's campaign told NBC News, "This is a totally expected political stunt by a feckless, politicized, weaponized Biden Department of Justice."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Tour the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world I hope you're all doing well You are listening my voice from IRIB English Radio and this is Youth Station I am Beta, a medical student at your service and today with me I have a very important candidate because today there is generation gap in our conversation I am a candidate from youth generation and with me I have brother Rohani who is the candidate of the older generation. Hello, brother. How are you doing?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much. I am Rohani, a student of Islamic seminary, and I got my PhD in Islamic philosophy, and now I'm teaching in Islamic seminary and universities.
Thank you very much. Actually, I'm really honored to have the pleasure to have the discussion of today with you. So we're going to go through a topic which actually I think most of the young generation is entangled with this problem. And I'm going to go straight to the topic, marriage. What do you think about the importance of this actually issue in the youth generation?
Particularly when it comes to the Western societies, or in European societies, we see sometimes according to the statistics, for example, and we can say according to some of the statistics, that from, for example, sometime 12, 14, or 15, for example, German or Swedish or Danish people, only one child remain. It is because of this that majority of the youth, majority of the young generation do not go to the marriage, do not marry. Because of what? Because all those kind of relationships, illegal relationships are available. So then they do not bear, they do not tolerate the marriage. This is the problem that nowadays we have in modern societies. Maybe Muslim youth may follow the same path, the same lifestyle.
Yeah.
So that's why it's really, really significant to talk about the importance of marriage from the Islamic perspective, from our religious perspective. You know, marriage in Islam has its own, let's say, importance. First of all, because of this, that the family is the first place or the first center that you understand, that you learn how to socialize, how to live with the society, how to live with the people. This is the first step. This is the first class that you learn the good behavior, the good treatment, the good, let's say, lifestyle from your parents. So the first teachers are the parents. And the first place that we learn everything is house, is family.
Family, yeah.
So that's why having family is really important, particularly mother and father, because mother loves really the child, really the baby. But if you give it to someone else to take care of him, of course, naturally, he or she does not love or does not like the kid or the child that much that the real mother or the real father
actually,
loves.
Let me tell you something. Yes. My generation is completely, actually, you know, just agree with whatever you just told me, that family is so important and we have to save this beautiful and, you know, somehow centered thing. But there is a problem here. For example, there is a mindset in my generation that tell, okay, we can be in a relationship. We don't want any children or something. And even we don't want to go under the responsibility of marriage. And that's okay with us. And what do you think about this mindset?
You know, first of all, as I told you, that if in some decades later, we will see, for example, nowadays it is said in Britain Parliament, the MP members are of the view that maybe for two or three decades later, we will not have an original British man in this parliament. Because nowadays, you see, the Prime Minister of Britain is an Indian one. He's originally Indian.
Yeah.
The mayor of London is a Pakistani, let's say, Muslim. This is what is going on in European society because European youth, they themselves do not want to go to marriage. They do not take the responsibility of marriage. So because of this, the next generations, the coming generations that come from Africa, Asia, from Latin America or other places into Europe, they will be replaced by the original generation of European people.
Yeah.
It is something that's happening. If you go to Europe, you see that Muhammad is the name, the most popular name in Britain.
Okay.
You see? Or for example, majority, it's about the majority of the residents of Paris will become Muslims in some decades later. You know, because of what? Because the Muslim take responsibility of marriage according to the traditions, according to the Islamic rulings. But in modern schools of thought, in modern, let's say, societies, the youth do not care about it. Nowadays, it is European themselves and the British Parliament a few years back, they were trying to find a solution to this problem that, okay, these premature sexual relationship between the youth and this illegal kind of relationship, this illegal kind of contact, it had a very disastrous kind of outcome and result for both the youth, for the different
for
generations
the society,
in Europe and America. So this is now they want to find the solution to this problem, but they couldn't do that. So why should we follow the same way?
I understand you.
You know, one of the outcome, one of the result of this is that we will face a kind of extinction of the generation. And this is a really disastrous kind of outcome for the youth.
So you're telling me that because of these problems which will make for society or something, we have to go under this actually responsibility. And this is, you know, you shouldn't be that much selfish. You have to think more of yourself. There is society, there is country, there is nationality, and there is religion. You have to sprout the people that have the same religion as you, because this is the right way to do that. So this is the thing we have discussed up to here. If you do agree with me, we're going to go for a break and then we're going to come back. Welcome back. This is Youth Station, and I am BT at your service. We are discussing actually a controversial topic, which is marriage, and why should we go under the responsibility of being married to someone at a time that there are many other kinds of relationships available. And one thing which remained actually cliffhanger for me, myself, was the age, the appropriate age for marriage. What do you think about it? There is actually an important factor for age or something, or no, age actually doesn't play an important role in this topic.
Why not? Of course, age does play a very key role, a very significant role in marriage. Actually, naturally, when someone becomes mature, the age of puberty or age
of... So you mean physically?
Yeah. Physically, when not only physically, but also in terms of their mindset and...
But do you know that they are not at the same time?
Their intellectuality.
Yeah.
So both should be there. Sometimes someone might physically be mature or the age of puberty. But of course, when it comes to his mindset, his worldview, we can say, his ideas, thoughts, of course, he might not be... in a suitable age for marriage. Of course, that person should not marry, should not go towards marriage, I mean. So, of course, age is important, but we cannot specifically tell, okay, in this certain age, you have to marry. It depends. It depends on conditions.
Yeah.
It depends on the situation. It depends on your family.
But there should be a golden duration.
Yeah, from the Islamic perspective, of course, the age of puberty for women or for girls are the age 9 years old, and for the boys, it is 15 years old, of course. But of course, in Islam, we do not actually obliged to, for example, marry, for example, someone who is 10 years old or 9 years old. No, of course, it's not like that. But the age of puberty is that. But the suitable age for marriage could be some 18, 19, 20. Sometimes also it depends on the culture, on the social values that your society have. It might be different, you know? For example, it is said Mahatma Gandhi married someone who was... The girl was 13 years old, and there was no problem with that. If you go and research about
Mahatma Gandhi was at what age?
He was much older than that.
But I think this is a problem.
This is the custom. This is the tradition.
Because it is a cultural thing or this is a custom, we cannot tell that it is true.
Mm.
And we have to try to change it. For example, when there is a lot of age gap between the couples in a marriage, there would be a lot of problem, and you cannot ignore that. For example, a 13-year-old girl and, I don't know, a 50-year-old man. What does that mean? You know, I cannot accept that. And I am from your generation.
You know, it depends.
It doesn't depend, actually.
It's sometimes a girl might be really mature, both in terms of intellectual maturity and also physical maturity. There might be someone, but some exceptional cases. But of course, mostly we can say, for example, the age should be upper than 15 or 16. 20 maybe sometimes.
In our country, actually, the legal age is 15, I think, for girls.
Of course.
Yeah. And,
but the problem is that in the Western societies, you know, they do not marry even when they become 40, 50, 45 years old. So that's not a good tradition. That's not a good lifestyle to be followed by Muslims.
Actually, exceptions don't break a rule, but I think there are some people which, even in Western countries that are not Islamic or something, but they are committed to this responsibility. And you cannot tell me that, okay, because his or her religion is different, they don't want to go under this responsibility only because of this matter. No, it's not like that, I think. And even in European countries, there are some traditional areas, and different series that, you know, even they marry at a young age, even younger than in our own country. And I do agree with the cultural part, but I think there should be a golden duration for marriage. And this golden duration, I think, is 23 to 28, in my opinion only. This is somehow personal. When it goes upper than 28 years old or something, the problem is that your choices are limited. You know, you cannot go find someone that is exactly according to you, whatever you want, because your choices are limited. And this is the problem of actually marrying someone in old ages.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Also, in young ages, there are some problems because your mindset and your personality, I think, is not complete until 25 years old, in my opinion. You will change, and this change will make you regret whatever you did in the past. This is a problem.
You know, we should consider this important point that there is a difference between Islamic lifestyle and modern lifestyle. In modern lifestyle, there is a kind of individualism. It means that when, for example, the daughter or the son become, for example, like 18 years old, then they become independent. You know, their parents, their family members tell her, for example, the boy or the girl, that now you're independent. You have to go and find your own job, your own, let's say, you have to start your own life. But in Islamic lifestyle, it's not like that. Islamic lifestyle, it's the duty, it's the responsibility of the parents to help, to support their children, even if they are 20, even if they are 24, 25, or 30 years old, up to the time that they could have, that they could make, for example, their own life. Up to that time, it is the responsibility of the parents to help, to support them. That's why in Islam, we have this, that, for example, the grandma, grandpa should be there, mother and father should be there, and they should help and they should support. But even in 25, even sometimes in the age of 30 for men and women, sometimes even at that age, they might not be that much ready, that much fully prepared to start, for example, a new life. Even up to that age, they might be in need of support, in need of help. That's why I think if we follow the Islamic lifestyle, we could solve these kind of problems. But of course, if we, for example, tell our daughters and our sons that, okay, at the age of 20, at the age of 18, you have to go and find out your own job and to bear your own responsibilities of marriage. Of course, it becomes so much difficult for them.
Yeah, I understand.
It becomes so much hard for them. That's why they might not will to marry someone, because they see the difficulties and the problems. But if there will be the grandma, grandpa, father, mother, brothers, let's say uncle, aunt, whatever, if they support them, if they help them, of course, in that way, life becomes easy.
Of course. So in summary, you're telling me that the family and relative connection will always help you in this actually difficult road. And the tendency to being married to someone is something that actually should grow from the puberty age to the mental puberty. And from this gap, you have to actually make yourself prepare for this responsibility and understand that you have to do this for not only yourself and your own need and your own nature, but also for the society, for your religion, for your country, and so on. So there are actually some other more discussions, but unfortunately we're running out of time, and that was all for today's episode. I hope it was actually useful for you, your listeners, and you enjoy it. I bid you farewell, and I leave you in the warm embrace of God. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Recently, Saudi Arabia's King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, as part of reshuffling the country's cabinet, appointed Mohammed bin Salman as the head of Riyadh's Council of Ministers. During this appointment, the Saudi Crown Prince's lawyers told the American court that the new position of Mohammed bin Salman as the head of the Council of Ministers will give him judicial immunity from prosecution in the case of Jamal Khashoggi's murder. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Hill newspaper has covered this story. The U.S. Department of State has given Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman immunity from a lawsuit over the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, despite President Biden's earlier promise to hold the de facto ruler accountable for the crime. In a statement on Thursday, 17th of November, the U.S. State Department announced that it recognizes and allows the immunity. Citing its constitutional authority as well as customary international law, the U.S. State Department said Prime Minister bin Salman, as a sitting head of government, is immune while in office from the jurisdiction of the United States District Court in this lawsuit. Atif Cengiz, the fiancé of the murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was also the founder of Democracy for Arab World Now, has filed a lawsuit over the terrible murder in the Federal District Court of Washington, D.C. The lawsuit charges that Khashoggi, a U.S. resident and a Washington Post columnist, was tortured, murdered, and dismembered under orders of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The CIA has previously confirmed that the Saudi Crown Prince was in fact personally behind the murder. Back in late September, Mohammed bin Salman was named as Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia in a move that experts believe was linked to the lawsuit in a bid to shield him from legal prosecution. Reacting to the new development and while using the hashtag injustice, Atif Cengiz took to Twitter and wrote, "Jamal died again today. We thought maybe there would be a light to justice from USA, but again, money came first." Meanwhile, the executive director of Dawn, Sarah Leah Whitson, also slammed the Biden administration's decision as a capitulation to Saudi pressure tactics. She wrote in a separate post on Twitter, "It's beyond ironic that President Biden has single-handedly assured Mohammed bin Salman can escape accountability when it was President Biden who promised the American people he would do everything to hold him accountable. Not even the Trump administration did this." President Biden came under fire back in July for fist-bumping Mohammed bin Salman on a visit to Saudi Arabia to discuss energy and security issues. Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered by a Saudi hit squad in the Saudi Arabia's consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey, in October of 2018, used to be a vocal critic of the kingdom and its crown prince. The Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, concluded back in 2018 that Mohammed bin Salman had ordered the murder of Khashoggi, contradicting Saudi Arabia's insistence that the Crown Prince had no prior knowledge of the plot. The Saudi Prince has denied ordering Khashoggi's murder, but acknowledged later that it took place under my watch. Saudi officials later blamed rogue agents for the murder. The website of Middle East Monitor has also covered the same story. The U.S. decision that has granted Mohammed bin Salman sovereign immunity in a lawsuit over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi means that despite the certainty of the U.S. intelligence community that the 37-year-old Mohammed bin Salman authorized the murder in 2018, any prospect of holding the Crown Prince legally accountable for the killing is blocked. In a filing released on Thursday, 17th of November, the Biden administration said the Crown Prince's recent promotion to the role of Prime Minister meant that he was the sitting head of government and accordingly immune from lawsuit filed by Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, in March of last year. The Department of Justice claimed in its court filing, "The United States government has expressed grave concerns regarding Jamal Khashoggi's horrific killing and has raised these concerns publicly with the most senior levels of the Saudi government," adding that the United States has also imposed financial sanctions and visa restrictions related to the murder. The U.S. Department of Justice added, "However, the doctrine of a head of state immunity is well established in customary international law and has been consistently recognized in long-standing executive branch practice as a status-based determination that does not reflect a judgment on the underlying conduct at issue in the litigation." The decision is seen as another sign of capitulation by the Biden administration and President Biden himself, who came into office describing the Saudi kingdom as a pariah state and saying he would hold the crown prince to account for the murder. His trip to Riyadh in July of this year, which critics described as a humiliation for the U.S. president, was the first sign of a U-turn by the Biden administration. Democracy for the Arab World Now says the Biden administration's suggestion of immunity for Mohammed bin Salman isn't just a mistake as a matter of law, it's a mistake as a matter of policy. Sarah Leah Whitson of Dawn said, "The Biden administration's decision to suggest immunity for Mohammed bin Salman in our lawsuit was an unnecessary elective action that will serve only to undermine the most important action for accountability for Jamal Khashoggi's heinous murder." The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. Dawn is a co-plaintiff in the case, with charge that Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other Saudi officials acted in a conspiracy and with premeditation when Saudi agents kidnapped, bound, drugged and tortured and killed Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey in October of 2018. The Biden administration's decision, which in effect will extinguish Hatice Cengiz's last hope for justice, will likely be met with intense criticism by Democratic lawmakers on Capitol Hill, who have pressed the administration to take a tougher line against its West Asian partner. One lawyer close to the matter said the decision was disastrous for accountability, for human rights and for impunity. The legal decision also makes clear that U.S. President Joe Biden has fully abandoned the campaign promise to hold the Saudi crown prince accountable for Khashoggi's murder. People familiar with the matter said the decision was reached after a big debate at the top levels of the White House, with some senior U.S. officials arguing that it will be difficult to defend the Biden administration's claim that human rights are at the center of its foreign policy, while simultaneously allowing Mohammed bin Salman to skirt accountability for his alleged role in the murder. It has been clear since June that the future of the case hinged on a question of whether, in the eyes of the U.S. government, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, widely seen as Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, was considered a sovereign, like a president or a king, since in most cases sovereigns are considered immune from U.S. lawsuits. When Biden first entered the White House, he declined to engage with Prince Mohammed bin Salman directly. His press secretary argued repeatedly at the time that the prince, though seen as Saudi Arabia's de facto leader, was not Biden's counterpart. At the same time, U.S. intelligence agencies released an unclassified report that said Prince Mohammed had ordered Jamal Khashoggi's murder.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, consequences of bad manner. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the consequences of bad manners in the Islamic lifestyle. What we see is that the manner has been divided into the good manner and bad in the Islamic teachings. Once it is said it is husn-e khulq, which means that it is a good manner. And Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam is the role model for us, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent him as the role model for the mankind. And we need to follow in order to have the husn-e khulq or the good manners. On the other hand, when we refuse to follow the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the teachings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we try to follow what it's been said by this material world for us, therefore, we lack in the manners, and sometimes we have the bad manners. And therefore, what we see is that this bad manner causes the mischievousness in our life. We become mischievous in our life, and we deal with the people with the bad manners, and we do not have the patience in our life. Therefore, it is necessary to stop us from dealing with the people with the bad manner or trying to reform ourselves so that we can become someone who has the good manner. Why? Because the effects that are said about the good manner, for example, it brings the love amongst the people. It increases the length of the life if someone has a good manner. But on the other hand, if he has not, then obviously it's from the other side that he will not live for long. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the consequences of bad manner in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that having a good manner has some results. One of them is that a person's life gets longer. But if he has a bad manner, obviously his life becomes shortened. The other effect of having good manner is that Allah gives izzah. Respect. People does respect him. People respect him. And if he has a bad manner, it's for the other way. Obviously, people will not respect such a person who deal with the people with the bad manner or the one who's too much moody. On the other hand, the good manner increases the sustenance, whereas the bad manner will not increase the sustenance. And on the other hand, it will decrease the sustenance because then someone is dealing, socializing amongst the people and he is not dealing with them in a good way. They don't want him to work anymore. They don't want to work with such a person. So these are the effects and consequences that can be found when someone is basically, you know, having a bad manner. On the other hand, in hereafter, it is said that if someone has a good manner, then his accounts or the question answer is easier for him. Whereas on the other hand, it becomes difficult. Therefore, we must avoid the things that causes us to have a bad manner or to deal with the people in a bad way. Therefore, we need to deal with the people in a good manner. And once we deal with the people in a good manner, then we will not be called any more arrogant. We will not be called someone who is just thinking about himself. Rather, we will care about ourselves, people, the society, family, and everyone, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
At a meeting in Brussels, Belgium on Wednesday, 12th of October, more than 50 pro-Ukrainian countries pledged to increase the delivery of more weapon systems to Ukraine. Meanwhile, at a recent UN Security Council meeting, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said, providing weapons and ammunition to Kiev indicates the direct involvement of the West and Western countries in this war. The Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov said some countries are seeking to prolong the war in Ukraine. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website libertarianinstitute.org has covered this story. The United States and its NATO allies are accelerating transfer of arms, warm clothing and anti-drone technology to Ukraine in preparation for months of bitter combat through the winter. Washington believes shoring up frontline forces before modern ice set in will help Kiev to hold ground over the coming season. Speaking on the condition of anonymity during a recent NATO summit in Berlin, Germany, a Western official told reporters that the alliance had already started providing winter clothing, gear, to the Ukrainian side. The anonymous official said, "The Ukrainians are on their front foot and they certainly feel prepared for the winter campaign, and that foreign aid is currently very much focused on the winter." While top officials acknowledge that the snow, mud and ice of winter will slow troop movements, they believe Kiev can continue to push counter-offensives against Russian soldiers despite the frigid temperatures. America's Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said after a meeting in Brussels, Belgium, he said, "I expect that Ukraine will continue to do everything it can throughout the winter to regain its territory and to be effective on the battlefield." Russian President Vladimir Putin has vowed to use his entire arsenal to defend all of Russia, including four recently annexed regions of Ukraine, which voted to join the Russian Federation in a referendum recently. NATO Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg has echoed Lloyd Austin's claims about Ukraine's chances to make progress against the Russians during the cold season. Jens Stoltenberg said, "Our task is to enable them to also be able to conduct meaningful operations throughout the winter months and continue to supply them with everything from fuel, winter clothing, tents, to advanced weapons systems." Kiev has heavily depended on the West to train its soldiers and supply arms, ammunition and battlefield intelligence since Russian forces started their special operation in February of this year. In that time, the White House has approved at least $70 billion worth of aid to Kiev, much of that devoted to heavy weapons and vehicles, including long-range multi-launch rocket platforms, artillery pieces, shoulder-fired rockets, helicopters and drones. Though U.S. stockpiles have become increasingly depleted after countless rounds of arms shipments, the flow of aid appears set to carry on at the present pace, with the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin recently declaring that Washington will continue to do everything we can to make sure that they have what's required to be effective. NBC News has also covered the same story. Amid skepticism that a new Congress could withhold military aid to Ukraine, lawmakers from both major U.S. political parties are looking to lock in billions of dollars in military assistance to Kiev before new members are sworn in this January. A lawmaker and congressional aide said, on condition of anonymity, the package being contemplated would be dramatically larger than the $12 billion in military and economic aid the U.S. Congress approved recently for Ukraine. A Republican senator said the amount would be enough to make sure that Ukraine can get through the year, adding, it'll make the $12 billion look like pocket change. Congressional aides and a source close to the Ukrainian government said the new aid package, which most likely would be part of an omnibus spending bill, could be within the range of roughly $50 billion. According to NBC News, which also noted that the Biden administration has not yet made a formal request for new funding, U.S. Congress has allocated a total of $65 billion in funding for Kiev since Russia began its special military operation in Ukraine in last February, pointing to concerns that a new Congress could take a more skeptical view of aid to Ukraine. The U.S. broadcaster NBC News underlined that both Republican and Democratic legislators currently in power are looking to lock in the huge military aid package before new members due to be elected in the upcoming midterm elections on 7th of November take office in January. Many Republican candidates endorsed by former President Donald Trump have challenged the amount of American aid already shipped to Ukraine, arguing that the United States has more pressing domestic issues to deal with, and the fate of Ukraine is not tied to American national interests, and that European allies should be delivering a larger share of weapons and other aid to Kiev. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden attacked the position of Republican politicians on Ukraine on Thursday, 20th of October. However, right-wing House Republican lawmakers argue that America needs to shore up its southern border with Mexico and address the issue of illegal immigration before worrying about the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Euronews has also covered the same story, but from a slightly different angle. The United States has announced its plan to supply Ukraine with more deadly weapons, despite Russia's repeated warnings to the West about exacerbating the conflict. The Pentagon announced on Monday, 17th of October, that the first batch of National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems, or NASAMS, will be sent to Ukraine within the coming weeks. The ground-based short-to-medium-range missile system, also known as the Norwegian Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile System, aims to aid the Kiev military as more attacks are launched against Russian targets. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said on Tuesday, 18th of October, the alliance will deliver eight defense systems to Ukraine in the coming days to help the country defend itself against Russian drones, which are targeting critical infrastructure in Ukraine. Ukraine said attacks by swarm of drones had destroyed almost a third of its power stations in recent days after Russia stepped up its attacks on infrastructure far from the front line after suffering a string of military setbacks at the hand of Ukrainian troops. Addressing a security conference in Berlin, Germany, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said the answer to the attacks was the Allies to step up their deliveries of air defense systems. He said, "The most important thing we can do is to deliver on what Allies have promised, to step up and deliver even more air defense systems to Ukraine." Jens Stoltenberg added, "NATO will in the coming days deliver counter-drone systems to counter the specific threat of drones." Also, Britain's Defence Secretary Ben Wallace says Britain will supply Ukraine with advanced air defence missiles capable of shooting down cruise projectiles following Russian strikes on Kiev and other Ukrainian cities in recent days. The missile authorised for shipment to Ukraine is called the Advanced Medium Range Air-to-Air Missile, or AMRAAM.
الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. They claim that the reason why the Americans stood up against the Iranian nation was because of what you did at the embassy. That is, you attacked our embassy, and as a result, a dispute was formed, a fight was created, an enmity was formed. They are lying. That's not the issue. The dispute between the Iranian nation and the U.S. began on August 19th, 1953. On August 19th, a national government was at work. Mossadegh's government was a national government, and the issue he had with the West was about oil. Mossadegh was neither a Hujjatul Islam cleric, nor did he claim to want Islam. It was just about oil. The country's oil was in the hands of the British. He said our oil needs to be in our hands. That was his only crime.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Americans staged a coup d'etat, a very bizarre coup d'etat. There are some vague things about that event in my mind. I was 14 years old then. There is a big difference between the time that we were 14 or 15 years old and today's teenagers. Today, you understand and analyze things accurately, but that is not how it was for us back then. I have read the history behind it and am aware of the details. The Americans sat and conspired against Mossadegh and crafted a coup. Even though Mossadegh trusted the Americans, he trusted them. He even liked them. He thought that the US government would support him against the British, but they stabbed him in the back. They sent their agent, whose name was Kermit Roosevelt, to Iran. They had coordinated it with the English. They sent him to Iran with a suitcase full of dollars. He went to the British embassy. He didn't even go to the American embassy. He coordinated it with some traitorous military personnel and a number of British-affiliated elements.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with the reporters.
An incident that caused Iranians a great deal of agony. Iranian mourners took part in the funeral procession of the victims of the terror attack in the city of Izeh in floods of tears. In addition to expressing their deepest sympathy with families of the victims, the participants also voiced their support for the Islamic Republic amid the enemy's efforts to destabilize the country.
We have taken part in this funeral procession to send a message to the U.S. and Israel. They must know that Iran is not alone. We support the leader of the Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation. They cannot sow division in Iran by killing civilians. We will be victorious.
My fellow countrymen and dear people of Izeh, be sure that the Islamic Republic is strong and will definitely take revenge for the blood that has been shed by all the cruel enemies who are servants of the criminal government of the United States.
Also, a number of high-ranking state and military officials attended the funeral, vowing to bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice as soon as possible.
The perpetrators of this crime will be punished. A number of them have been arrested, while some others have been identified. Some of them attempted to flee the country through border crossings. However, they have been arrested. We will inform the Iranian nation about arresting the rest of the perpetrators in the coming days.
Officials say so far 11 individuals who've been involved in IZ terrorist attack have been detained. Seven people, including a 9-year-old child and a woman, were killed, while 11 others were wounded after gunmen started shooting at people in the center of the city.
The terrorist attack was completely pre-planned. The terrorists broke the cameras across the city by shooting at them 24 hours prior to the attack. Then the next day, they opened fire at people at a crossroad from two directions. Their goal was to cause a massive bloodshed.
Rezaei said the enemies cannot turn Iran to another Syria or Lebanon by carrying out violent acts like the ones in Shahcharagh, Isfahan, and Izeh.
Iranian officials have strongly condemned the recent terror attacks in the country. They say the enemies of the Islamic Republic have now resorted to armed terror attacks that target civilians because they have failed to advance their anti-Iran agenda through creating media hype. Mahdi Abbasian, Izeh, Khuzestan.
The trailer released on Thursday for the documentary movie From Tehran to Tirana is so powerful in its message about the MKO and its practices that it leaves no room for doubting why every defector that has managed to flee insists on calling it a cult where members are required to demonstrate complete devotion to its leader.
Ever since I joined the MKO in Iraq and I realized that they had lied about everything, I wanted to leave, but it was almost impossible. Finally, when we were relocated to Albania, I found the opportunity to escape. Many inside the camp are not as lucky as me.
The movie is inspired by a book of the same name written by a defector who managed to escape the camp 2 decades ago and who has dedicated his life to raising public awareness about the MKO.
Nejat NGO was founded by a number of defectors about 15 years ago. Our mission is to reunite families with their loved ones and help defectors escape. We also try to raise awareness about this cult and how they recruit people.
Leaving the camp is almost impossible. I was recruited when I was a prisoner of war in Iraq. I was told that they would help me go home. I later found out that Saddam had allowed this. And also I met members who had come to Camp Ashraf with false promises of employment or asylum in Western countries and brought into Iraq illegally. We were all asked to submit our passports and ID cards, which effectively trapped us there.
The movie also highlights the new methods of recruitment through social media platforms by the MKO's so-called keyboard warriors, a group of about 300 MKO members who run fake social media accounts.
Parents should be very careful. They are now using new methods to recruit the younger generation. They ask these young people to go out on the streets and take part in riots and send them pictures and videos.
This is not the first time the MKO is using social media to advance its agenda. Previous reports by other TV channels has also revealed their strategy.
Should comment by the different account and not MKO members, Mujahideen, because we want to show the Iranian people support Maryam Rajavi.
So you were a troll?
Yes.
You were an internet troll?
Yes.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization, or the MKO, is a known terrorist organization. It has killed more than 17,000 Iranians over the past 43 years, and now it is actively involved in riots in Iran by instigating the younger generation through social media to carry out acts of vandalism. The best way to counter this terrorist organization is to raise public awareness, and this is the main focus of the movie. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens.